Hello, I'm Alton Banks for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading from the Triangle Business Journal. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. And as we turn the front page for this week's Triangle Business Journal, we arrive at the biz page. And we find several nice articles here. First one is labeled Downtown, and the article is New Restaurant Debuts in Revived Cary Hotel. A swank new restaurant has opened in the Cary Hotel that has been revamped since emerging from bankruptcy in 2020. Downtown Cary has sizzled in recent years, but the Mayton Inn struggled, and owners Colin and Deanna Crossman filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy in September 2018. A group of local investors rallied to grab the property and, as Academy Park Hospitality, bought the inn for $8.1 million in a bid approved by a bankruptcy court. That group partnered with Early Bird Night Owl Hospitality, the team behind the Durham Hotel, to manage the Mayton. The Peck and Plume Restaurant, previously the Veranda, is now open at the hotel as an upscale take on classic American fare, with a menu featuring North Carolina seafood, strip steaks, pork chops, shrimp and grits, and more. The 44-room hotel has been rebranded as the Mayton. The property is adjacent to the downtown Cary Park, scheduled to open in the summer of 2023. Greg Spitzer, CEO of Early Bird Night Owl, says the restaurant hopes to become an extension of the park, where people can enjoy a cocktail on the outdoor terrace, a breakfast meeting in the cozy study, or a celebratory dinner in our dining room. And under the heading of insurance comes the article, Tickets Mean High Costs for NC Drivers. Bad driving means serious payouts in North Carolina, new research from LendingTree shows. A driving under the influence, accident, or speeding ticket in North Carolina could cost you nearly $1,300 in coverage premiums alone. According to the research, that makes the state the eighth most expensive for bad drivers. And under the heading, Class is in Session, comes the article, Chapel Hill Restaurant Finds New Option to Reach Clients. A longtime Indian restaurant in Chapel Hill made all the well-known COVID pivots, including contactless service, curbside pickup, and outdoor dining. But unlike other restaurants, it also added the option for customers to subscribe for monthly access to virtual cooking classes, chef-curated meals, and beverage kits. Vimala Rajendran, chef and owner of Vimala's Curry Blossom Cafe, located at 431 West Franklin Street, Suite 415, said she started offering three subscription packages in October. And the response has been so positive that Rajendran envisions keeping these options post-COVID to continue forging deeper connections with customers and diversifying her sources of revenue. It'll be one of those things that was brought on because of the pandemic, but will linger on because something good has to come out of a catastrophic experience like the pandemic, she says. Vimala's Curry Blossom Cafe is one of over 100 restaurants nationwide using Table 22 to create an additional revenue stream through monthly customer memberships, and only one of two places in North Carolina. Big C Waffles in Durham also offers a subscription-based waffle club starting at $15 per month for local pickup. And under the heading of Finally comes the article, Class of 2020 will get to celebrate in Chapel Hill. You don't think of October as a big month for commencements in the Triangle, but it will be in Chapel Hill. UNC plans a full series of events for the class of 2020, which of course graduated during the height of the pandemic. While the pandemic has frayed nerves across the country, it was especially brutal for college and high school seniors who saw rites of passage stripped away because of quarantine. Carolina plans a bell tower climb on October the 8th, events around a Tar Heel football game on October the 9th, and then commencement in Keenan Stadium on October the 10th at 1 p.m. And under the heading of Rooftop Pool, the article, ECU students get new housing option. Raleigh-based DeWitt Carolinas recently opened its Jolly Roger student living community at East Carolina University. The 4.6-acre site, which sits on Charles Boulevard at 14th Street, features seven stories and 294 units that can accommodate up to 804 students. The complex also features the only rooftop pool in the Greenville student housing market, DeWitt Carolina says. The project includes salvaged items from the Jolly Roger Mini Mart and homes that existed in the area previously. And finally, on today's biz page, under the heading of For Charity, comes the article, Tough Tickets Worth $1 Million. The V Foundation for Cancer Research raised over $12 million at its week-long wine celebration in Napa Valley this month for immunotherapy research. But the highlight of the event was a live-action gala where an opportunity to see Coach Mike Krzyzewski at his last home game on Duke University reeled in a top bid of $1 million. Michael Marks, the founder of Silicon Valley-based venture capital firm Celesta Capital, won the weekend trip to watch Duke take on UNC Chapel Hill in the game that has been deemed the legend's last legacy. The V Foundation honors former NC State University coach Jim Valvano, who died of cancer in 1993. Krzyzewski and Valvano became coaches in the ACC in the same year, 1980, and Krzyzewski often visited Valvano when he was sick and being treated in Durham. Duke will host Carolina on March the 5th in what will be one of the toughest sports tickets in North Carolina history. And we turn the page and reach the tech and banking page of this week's Triangle Business Journal. And under the heading of biotech comes the article, Tempest Targets RTP for Jobs. A next-generation healthcare firm is expanding in Research Triangle Park and looking to hire 200 employees as it works to use artificial intelligence to improve patient outcomes. Tempest, a biotechnology company based in Chicago, plans to open a new 52,000-square-foot genomic sequencing lab, its third such laboratory after facilities in Chicago and Atlanta. Kimberly Yates, Vice President of Lab Operations for Tempest, says the location decision came down to talent. "It's just a great opportunity for us to utilize the resources that are already invested there," she says, pointing to the Triangle's plethora of research firms and universities. Tempest, founded in 2015 by Groupon co-founder Eric Lefkofsky, raised $200 million in late 2020 with backing that included support from Google. The RTP lab is expected to open in late 2021 and will run the company's broad panel solid and liquid assays, among others, which generate high-quality somatic and germline molecular data that can be used by physicians to personalize patient treatments. Brett Mayen, Vice President of Clinical Pathology for Tempest, describes its technology as a next-generation frequency test, one that could be used for all types of cancer. Researchers will be looking for everything from DNA alterations in a tumor to its RNA, details physicians can someday use to target the cancer with personalized treatments. And under the heading of More Hires comes the article, Texas FinTech to Expand in Raleigh, with fresh backing from Carlyle. 3 years after the acquisition that brought it to Raleigh, an Austin, Texas-based software firm is growing its coffers, a move its CEO says means jobs in the Triangle. Abrigo, which develops compliance, risk, and lending solutions for banks, announced on August the 3rd that it has secured what it described as a strategic growth investment from funds managed by the Carlyle Group. Financial details were not disclosed, but Abrigo's current majority backer, Accel KKR, retains a significant equity stake in the company. Bloomberg reported the Carlyle investment values Abrigo at more than $1 billion. Abrigo, which has 215 employees in the Triangle, entered the region with Accel KKR's 2019 acquisition of Raleigh-based fintech SageWorks. Today, the Triangle is Abrigo's largest footprint in terms of headcount, even larger than its Austin headquarters, CEO Wayne Roberts says. And the plan for the new capital is to, quote, heavily invest in our existing business, so absolutely hiring is something you would see in Raleigh, unquote. And while it started with SageWorks, Abrigo has expanded its scope locally. In 2018, Abrigo folded in another acquisition, that of Main Street Technologies, and many of those employees were consolidated in the Triangle, according to Roberts. And finally, on the tech and banking page from this week's journal, under the heading of Growth in North Carolina, Comerica Bank of Dallas making a move into Raleigh. Dallas-based Comerica Bank has tapped Raleigh for its North Carolina headquarters as it rolls out its new Southeast strategy. The bank will establish three new commercial offices in Raleigh, Winston-Salem, and Charlotte, creating a new Southeast market. Leading the charge in North Carolina will be Raleigh's Jerry Bowen, Southeast Market President for Comerica, who joined the bank earlier this year from Wells Fargo. Bowen says the bank is still finalizing its physical office space in the three markets, with more to potentially be announced in the next 30 days or so. But he hinted at aggressive plans, with at least a dozen employees staffed at each office, including Raleigh. That would include new hires, as well as bankers relocating. The bank has a pretty healthy list of customers today across the Southeast, Bowen says, defining the region as the Carolinas, Virginia, Georgia, and Florida. But step one as far as building out the Southeast really starts with North Carolina. We're going to start our build-out to the Southeast with North Carolina. And we turn the page and find in this week's Triangle Business Journal the retail and restaurants page. And under the heading of downtown comes the article, Raleigh Inn, sold for $1.75 million. A Raleigh-based developer has acquired a boutique hotel in the downtown area for $1.75 million, according to Wake County deed records. Loudon Properties now owns Guest House Raleigh, the early 20th century house that was transformed into an 8-bedroom inn at 420 South Bloodworth Street near East Cabarrus Street. Loudon Properties also developed and owns the Longworth Hotel, the Longleaf Hotel and Lounge on North Dawson Street. We truly think it has a place in the market, Loudon Properties partner Russ Jones says. There's nothing like it. What really drew us to the property was that I know the ins and outs of the construction. I know the contractor and the pieces they used for their bedrooms. It's all high quality, and they get the reviews to match it. Jones is a longtime friend of Matt Tomasulo, who previously owned the hotel with his wife, Nicole Alvarez. In 2016, the couple toured the folk Victorian home and decided to save it from being demolished and replaced by a condominium development. They bought the house from the nonprofit Historic Preservation Foundation of North Carolina, Inc. for $80,000, according to deed records. In 2017, they had the home moved from East Lenore Street, about six blocks away, to its current location. In 2018, they renovated the property and included a new addition. They did an amazing job at designing the property, says Jones, who has stayed at the hotel. It's an incredible asset. For Loudon Properties, since we owned the Longleaf in downtown Raleigh, it was more attractive for us to purchase than something else who didn't have anything here because we understand how the property should work. Loudon Properties has no immediate plans to change the 4,756-square-foot hotel, Jones says. A sale was completed August 4th, according to records. The property is in impeccable shape, he says. We'll do some work on the exterior landscape, but for the remainder of 2021, our goal is to get it fully integrated into our company. In the 1880s, The house was owned by Arthur Gorham, Raleigh's first African-American mailman, and his wife Annie, who was a teacher. And another article on the retail restaurants page, downtown Durham hotel exec optimistic as occupancy rebounds. The leaders of a downtown Durham hotel are optimistic about the future of the hospitality industry, despite uncertainty caused by the COVID-19 Delta variant. Like many others, Unscripted Durham, located at 202 Corcoran Street, struggled during the pandemic, but is now recovering as hotels see a surge in demand. Director of Sales Paul Mincy says the 74-room hotel's occupancy rate recently reached nearly 100% on weekends and about 70% midweek, after dropping to as low as 5% in 2020. Mincy says both leisure and business travelers have frequented the property because of its emphasis on safety while providing a unique and fun experience. Unscripted Durham, which opened in 2017, has 6 bars and restaurants and a large rooftop pool deck and lounge. Part of that experience included Unscripted's popular pop-up rooftop heated dining igloos during the winter months. They allowed for social distancing outdoors and will return this winter. And finally, on this week's retail and restaurant page, under the heading of New Tenant, comes the article, Clark Nexon Moving to Smoky Hollow. An architect and engineering firm in Raleigh has leased a 25,000-square-foot space at an office building in the Smoky Hollow development in Glenwood South. Clark Nexon is set to move to the mixed-use office building at 421 North Harrington Street by May of 2022, says Dennis Stallings, principal and design director. The Virginia-based company will relocate from Capital Bank Plaza on Fayetteville Street. Clark Nexon will occupy the 6th floor of the 9-story office building with 225,000 square feet of rentable space in total and 45,000 square feet of street-level retail space. Developers Kane Realty Corporation and Williams Realty and Building Company, in partnership with Lionstone Investments, are behind the Smoky Hollow project, which features office, apartment, and retail space. And next we turn to the Greater Triangle Growth page in this week's TBJ. And under the heading of Plan for Selma, New Stop for Johnston County. A renowned chef who has led restaurants in places such as New York City and New Orleans and other food halls across the country has big plans for a locale in Johnston County. Local developer Adventure Development recently brought on Hospitality HQ, led by Chef Akhtar Nawab, to serve as operator of Old North State Food Hall in Selma. What was appealing to Nawab was Old North State Food Hall was its location along the midpoint of Interstate 95, a well-traveled corridor on the East Coast. It makes a good stopover in many ways, and it creates what we're calling an interstate food hall, Nawab says. The food hall is part of the Triangle East Collaborative at Eastfield Crossing, a massive mixed-use development totaling 3 million square feet in Selma. HHQ is diving into local demographic data so it can find the right variety of restaurants that would work best for the 12,000-square-foot space, with an opening date set for early 2022. Old North State Food Hall was originally going to be operated by Lane Property Management with an opening date of spring 2020, but then the pandemic wreaked havoc on the restaurant industry and plans change. Nawab says his team at HHQ was happy to be reconsidered for the role. Nawab says announcements about tenants can be expected in the coming weeks. And under the heading of Potential Catalyst comes the article, Siler City Project to Bring Apartments and Brewery Downtown. A prominent developer in Siler City is hoping a new project can help revitalize the community's downtown area. The development, called Wren Corner Properties, will be located at the corner of Chatham Avenue and Raleigh Street in Siler City. Plans call for 16 apartments, a brewery, butcher shop, and restaurant, says Wren Farrar, general manager of Wren Family Estate, LLC. Farrar's mother's maiden name was Wren. We're hoping this will act as a catalyst to promote other areas of investment, Farrar says. The project has partnered with local firm Tribeca Hospitality Group to help run the butcher shop, restaurant, and brewery, Farrar says. Also plans for an outdoor beer garden. And a small article on the page under the heading of On the Rise, pre-leasing begins for First Flex Industrial Space at Chatham Park. The First Flex Industrial Space within the massive Chatham Park development is scheduled to come online next year. Chatham Park Commerce Center, which will sit near the U.S. Highway 64-64 business split at Eubanks Road in Pittsburgh, is now pre-leasing. Project plans call for 5 buildings initially, according to marketing materials. The first phases include a 71,000-square-foot flex space and a 35,000-square-foot warehouse-slash-flex-space on the east side of Eubanks Road. Plans also call for 3 additional buildings of 21,000, 28,000, and 12,000 square feet on the west side of Eubanks Road. Construction is slated to begin in January, with the first spaces delivering in fall of 2022. Well, we turn the page, and next we find this week's executive voice, and that belongs to James Montague. Now, his last name is M-O-N-T-A-G-U-E, and I believe that's Montague, and I'll just apologize if it is not. For 24 years, Raleigh real estate developer James Montague has built his company, F7 International Development, which started with a single retail plaza in southeast Raleigh, and now has projects around the world. Over the years, Montague has expanded his portfolio in his hometown of Raleigh with an eye for affordable housing and commercial investment in underserved areas. With Raleigh booming, Montague has doubled down on his Raleigh projects, including a recent development bringing STEM and business education to local residents and a contract with the developers behind the Downtown South project. Born and raised in southeast Raleigh, Montague started in entrepreneurship at the age of 14, cutting hair in his mother's house. "All the kids would come to my house and get haircuts," he says. "And at first, I sucked, I'll be honest. A lot of times now, people are afraid to get into something because they suck at it. But to me, that's a sense of fear. To me, I don't care about that now. I have faith." Montague invested his profits into an Atari video game system that customers could play. Soon, the house was packed with customers. "On an average day, I had 20 or 25 people in my mother's house playing video games," he says. "And that worked for maybe 2 or 3 years. And one day she said, 'Son, I don't know these people coming to my house. You got to get out of here. You got to do something.'" So Montague enrolled in barber school and opened his own shop at the age of 19. But a business mistake cost him the shop. "The landlord came in one day and told me, 'You have 30 days to be out of here. New owners had bought the building and you have to be out,' he says. So I'm like, 'Man, get out of here with that. No, get out here.' 30 days later, this guy comes in with a sledgehammer and starts knocking my walls down. I had people in my salon." Montague started looking for his own space, which would lead him to real estate. "That's when I decided to buy my own property," he says. "I said, 'I'm going to make it so I can never get kicked out of this place again.'" Montague was soon working 16-hour days, eating poorly and neglecting relationships when that caught up with him in 1997. "When I was 26, I had a stroke and almost died," he says. "The doctor told my mother I couldn't go back to what I was doing. It was stressing me out. But I just loved it. I was good. I traveled and did shows, so it really hurt me when I couldn't do that. So I had to find another thing to do." That year, he bought the land for the Statue Side Business Plaza on Rock Quarry Road in southeast Raleigh. The first building opened in 1999. Montague was rejected by 20 banks before landing funding. With each rejecting, he solicited feedback to better hone his pitch. I'm the kind of person that if you say no, no's fine, but why not? I'm not trying to prove you wrong, but what can I do to incorporate what you're saying to maybe get the next person to say yes, he says. So by the time I got to the 21st person, I was a pro. He looked like, wow, this is good. Montague has been growing ever since. Across the triangle, his company has built residential and commercial projects, including affordable and senior living communities and commercial plazas in underserved areas of the city. The company also has projects around the country, such as a project in Mississippi after Hurricane Katrina, and around the world, including a hospital in Nigeria. But now, Montague says, I'm focusing here because Raleigh is so hot right now. If you know this market, it could be the next Atlanta. People say Raleigh could be the next Charlotte. Raleigh's almost Charlotte now. If you give it another 5-10 years, it could be the next Atlanta. He recently broke ground on Montague Plaza in southeast Raleigh. Plans call for a $4 million building with 16,000 square feet of space for businesses and educational programs focused on entrepreneurship. Additionally, F7 has joined the Downtown South development and is working on existing industrial buildings that will be converted to retail and dining spots. Montague also has a number of affordable housing projects in the area. People don't want affordable housing. They need affordable housing, he says, but it makes it really tough because land costs are so high for developers like myself to do what we want to do. Meanwhile, developers continue to pour into Raleigh neighborhoods surrounding downtown. A recent trip with his wife gave Montague some perspective. We went to D.C. last year, and we went to a part of town that was gentrified, and we thought it was just nice, he says. But she said, I bet there are people who drive by this and don't get that warm, fuzzy feeling. You probably have people driving by that grit their teeth and say, I used to live here but got kicked out, and now I'm trying to find a place. We have to be cognizant of that. Today, F7 is a two-person operation run by Montague and his wife. In the years to come, he says, he hopes to bring new staff on board, as well as additional partnerships with firms around the area. We're scaling up. There's only so much you can grow as a mom and pop, he says. Next, we turn the page and we find an article under the heading of 52 Shades of Success. The 52 Shades of Success is a 52-week project showcasing accomplishments, challenges, and opportunities of individuals and businesses run by people of color, women, immigrants, veterans, representatives from the LGBTQ community, and other groups, forwarding the mission of diversity, equity, and inclusion in the greater Raleigh-Durham metro area. And this week's article is entitled, Maintaining a Global Reach. There was a time when Torbjorn Eidemer flew from Raleigh-Durham International Airport to Australia for a 45-minute sales meeting. Those days are gone, which is, ironically, one of the positive outcomes of the pandemic here. Businesses have realized that in some instances, virtual meetings can produce results comparable to in-person visits and do so with greater efficiency. Eidemer, president of IDCON, the global engineering firm his father started in 1972, said 2020 was a particularly challenging year for a business that coaches and consults with executives around the world. Eidemer assumed the leadership role at IDCON in 2009, grew up in Sweden, obtained an industrial engineering degree at NC State University, and returned to Sweden, where he earned a master's in mechanical engineering and served in the military before coming back to Raleigh to work at IDCON in 1997. We're a management consulting firm that focuses on reliability maintenance, which means maintenance of large equipment, Eidemer says. Most companies have low equipment reliability in their processes and high costs. That's the problem we solve for industries. How we do that is mostly through on-the-job training to change people's behavior. Before COVID, that work was done on site. But pandemic restrictions put an end to international travel for more than a year. When he spoke with Triangle Business Journal at the end of July, Itamar was embarking on his second international trip post-pandemic. His first was in May, but he doesn't expect international travel to approach 2019 levels until 2022 or beyond. Even then, remote meetings will remain part of the new normal. Over the past 18 months, IDCON, short for Itamar Consulting, has learned that many communications can and should be conducted virtually. Since COVID has come in waves in different parts of the world, it's been tricky to travel internationally, he says. COVID restrictions vary from one country to the next, and his upcoming trip involved plane changes across multiple countries, culminating in a train ride across Sweden. With offices in countries and continents across the world, from Montreal to Moscow to Sydney, IDCON has relied on its representative to travel within their own countries. One of our larger projects is in Chile, and we have people there who can travel within the country, Itamar says. We're doing interviews from here, but we have people in Chile who can go to the mine. For most of 2020, we couldn't travel even within the United States. During that time, IDCON transitioned to more online classes than on-the-job training, and to more virtual meetings and more engineering services. Overall, we've handled this pandemic better than I would have thought, but still, we had some downtime, he says. While sales have declined slightly since the onset of COVID, Itamar declines to quote the company's actual sales figures. He says profits have remained steady. Revenue was down around 75% in 2020, but the cost of doing business was also down about 75%, so while we didn't make the exact same profit in 2020 as before, percentage-wise, our profit was the same, he says. Itamar can't predict how this year will play out, but he expects it will be better than last year. I'm hoping 2022 is going to come back to normal, maybe more so. I'm managing conservatively, and we do travel less. That remains the case across industries. A survey in July for the Global Business Travel Association found only 14% of companies were allowing international business travel. Similarly, a Delta Airlines survey found that only 57% of its corporate customers expect to be back to full travel by the end of 2023. And the U.S. Travel Association, which reported that the $300 billion spent in 2019 by domestic and international business travelers declined to about $95 billion in 2020, has forecast business travel will not recover to 2019 levels until 2022. We've seen that we can move a lot more online than we thought. Typically, the first step in a project was to go in to understand the situation and how the company works. We always go on site to do that, to see the equipment. But really, 80% of the time is just talking to people, and we can do that online, Itamar notes. It's changed quite a bit since COVID. We may do interviews online when we start, and then spend 2 days on site instead of 5 days. What makes in-person meetings preferable to virtual are the cultural differences among countries. Itamar acknowledges there are different systems and different types of machinery across the various countries, but even more distinguishing are the cultural nuances. It's trickier to pick up differences in people and culture in an online meeting. You miss the body language and the subtle things you might pick up sitting in the same room, he notes. Zoom has proved effective for international meetings, he says, because it enables two audio channels with simultaneous translation, the same as what can be accomplished with a translator in an in-person meeting. IDCON works across all industry sectors, from mining to pulp and paper to fertilizers to food manufacturers, but the defining differentiator is that they work in heavy process industries. Think about any industry where an interruption of production is expensive, and that's where they call for our help, Itamar says. People ask how we can jump from mining with trucks underground to pharmaceuticals, and the thing is, it's all maintenance. All these plants are built out of similar mechanical and electrical components. They break down the same way, and they need to be managed very similarly, even though they are configured in different ways. We worked with everything from Tyson Chicken to Harley-Davidson motorcycles to Whirlpool refrigerators. It doesn't really matter. And the company's footprint is spread around the world with projects in Pakistan, Israel, Sweden, Brazil, Chile, Peru, Argentina, the U.S., and more. The company's employee base fluctuates from 35 to 50, depending on projects. Many members of the team, all of whom work exclusively for IDCON, prefer to do so as contractors rather than full-time staff. The business has always required considerable international travel, and while that changed during COVID, Itamar says ultimately his company remains people-focused. Our business is very much about working with people. It's maintenance reliability, but what we do to achieve that is change people's behavior, he says. We draw up the work process, show the workflow, and who does what. But we don't stop there. The hard part, and what takes a lot of time, is getting the organization to follow the processes. He calls it the no-do gap, that defining chasm between people being told what to do and each person actually understanding and embracing their responsibilities. Achieving that level of reliable performance requires some degree of face time, preferably in a one-on-one format. Our business needs to travel. We need to be working on site with people for a few weeks to work through any problems, he says. That flight to Australia for a 45-minute meeting, IDCON got the contract, so the travel paid off. But in a world accustomed to Zooming, sales meetings will more naturally occur in a virtual setting, and Itamar expects IDCON training sessions will continue to embrace a blended format, a combination of on-site and online. And now we reach this week's cover story in the Triangle Business Journal, and it's entitled An Unexpected Pandemic Winner. Tom and Natalie Deckel have been regulars at McIntyre's Books in Pittsburgh since 1994. Before the pandemic, they would visit the store a couple times a year and purchase about 6 books a visit. But when COVID hit, they upped their support and started visiting every 2 weeks. The Deckels say they spent 40% more on books during the pandemic, fueled by increased time to read and a desire to make sure the independent bookstore would survive the pandemic. Bookstores responded to the surge in reading with more online offerings that allowed them to survive while sales plummeted in many industries. While bookstore owners braced for the worst in March of 2020, fearing customers may not have disposable income to devote to books, in the end, the opposite came true. People had more time to read and were really buying books that they obviously had on their lifetime read list, like War and Peace became a bestseller, said Jason Jeffries, general manager at Quail Ridge Books in Raleigh. Jeffries said customers frequently purchased stacks of books rather than one or two, as was common pre-pandemic. Instead of spending $40 on books during a visit, he saw customers spend about $200. National print book sales surged to 750.9 million units in 2020, up 8.2% compared to 2019, according to book publishing data provider BookScan. Last year marked the highest year-over-year increase in print book sales since 2010. In total, bookstore sales generated more than $8.8 billion in 2020, an increase of $2.5 billion from 2019. As all of us are experiencing a lot of digital fatigue, the print book has kind of held its own, says Beverly Boitumelo Makubele, who opened Rafiwi Book Cafe in Durham in May. A good portion of the money ordinarily spent on other forms of entertainment, such as concerts and movie theaters and travel, landed in bookstores. And it helped that bookstores appeal to an audience that's educated and affluent, the types of people who retained their jobs during the pandemic, Makubele says. While over 100 independent bookstores have closed nationwide during the course of the pandemic, according to the American Booksellers Association, stores in the Triangle survive due to droves of local support and retooling to expand online sales. In fact, the climate for books is so favorable locally that in addition to Rafiwi Book Cafe opening, a Barnes & Noble is opening at the Village District, formerly Cameron Village, in September, and at least 2 other bookstores are expanding. But as other forms of entertainment return, the question bookstore owners have is, will this last? Bookstores generally rely on foot traffic and in-store customer browsing. Before the pandemic, Triangle bookstore owners say online sales accounted for 10% or less of their business. That changed as online sales became the main source of revenue for many months. Many store owners had to expand their online infrastructure, and others, such as McIntyre's Books, had to rush to set up ways to sell online. Jeffries says Quail Ridge Books' online sales went up 3,000% as store sales plummeted to zero. Online sales stabilized business at many bookstores, but it was a major change that presented new logistical challenges. When the pandemic hit, Governor Roy Cooper designated bookstores essential businesses, allowing staff to work from the store to fulfill orders while society was shut down. Jamie Fioco, owner of Flyleaf Books in Chapel Hill, says that was critical. That kept us alive, no doubt. If we had not been able to process the online orders that our customers were great enough to switch to, we would have been dead in the water for sure, she says. Wander Lorenz de Haas, co-owner of the Regulator Bookshop in Durham, says the bookstore turned into a warehouse. They offered curbside pickup, shipping, and delivery options to customers. He says the delivery option was popular for customers, but not an ideal arrangement for the store, as it cut into the store's already slim 40 to 45% profit margins on books due to increased expenses for employee time, gas, and insurance. The rise in independent bookstore revenues comes after the industry had concerns about survival as Amazon powered into the market. And Amazon still accounts for about 42% of total industry print book sales and an estimated 75% of online sales of print books, according to the American Booksellers Association. But during the pandemic, independent bookstores felt like they, at times, had a leg up on Amazon. There was a period of several months when Amazon deprioritized book sales and delivery, instead focusing on delivering essential household goods. More than that, the pandemic intensified some customers' desire to shop local and support businesses within the community rather than chains. People were aware that buying local more than ever meant something, and it was front of mind much more so than it usually is, Fioco says. When the pandemic hit, Shauna McNasby said she bought books from Amazon for the ease of it, but she felt guilty and soon returned to buying from McIntyre's Books, who accommodated her and her family's needs with curbside service and personal staff book recommendations. Jamie Sanchez, co-owner of Epilogue Books Chocolate Brews in Chapel Hill, says he frequently heard customers say they did not want to shop from Amazon and ask if he could order special order books for them. Sanchez says orders came in for as far as California, and he saw people intentionally want to support their independent Latinx-owned business. With Flyleaf's online sales, Fioco says gross sales in 2020 were the same as 2019, but profitability was down. She said she had to spend $20,000 on shipping materials and employee safety items such as personal protective equipment. Additionally, without in-person browsing in stores, Fioco says the stores do not sell as much of its higher-margin items, such as stationery and toys, that the store relies on to boost revenue. However, there was demand for puzzles at many local bookstores. Kibi Fitch, owner of McIntyre's Books, says sales were down 20% in 2020 from 2019. It was going to be our best spring in terms of quality events, just chock-a-block. And then the bottom fell out in March, she says. We were shut down and doing phone orders almost immediately. While 2020 was overall a steady year of sales, there were several surges in buying identified by owners. The first occurred in March when people stocked up on books, anticipating a week or two of lockdown, resulting in holiday-level sales at Flyleaf, Fioco says. A second wave of increased buying followed George Floyd's murder and the Black Lives Matter movement as orders for books on anti-racism and white privilege skyrocketed. Across the country, there was an influx of business to black-owned bookstores for popular anti-racist titles. Triangle Bookstores and local publishers saw the same demand for the titles, boosting their sales. As usual, the holiday season also increased book sales as people were buying books as gifts. Owners attribute the renewed interest in books to a form of escapism from the reality of COVID, an investment in self-education and relief from screen time. McNasby started homeschooling her 7-year-old son during the pandemic and says they started spending 50% more time reading. Instead of bickering over how much video time or how much game time my son had, All of a sudden, we were both sitting around the book and hoping to figure out what would happen on the next page, McNasby says. And so for us, books were really a way to bring us together and focus our attention on something positive during a time that was stressful. Many people had books in mind they wanted to read, but publishers who typically marketed books through book tours and events at bookstores and academic conferences had to transition to virtual methods. Director of UNC Press, John Scherer, says virtual marketing was successful. He hopes to continue hybrid marketing in the future because it provided access to new opportunities and expanded reach. UNC Press publishes about 110 books a year, with most being scholarly, a rate that continued during the pandemic. We couldn't go to an exhibit in person for less than like $4,000, and now you have these virtual exhibits that cost a few hundred to get in there, so in some ways we went to places that we never would have gone before, he says. Publisher Lynn York of Blair, a small nonprofit press based in Durham, says that while exposure may grow, the downside of holding virtual events is they do not produce the same conversions to sales as in-person events normally do. The forced growth and reliance on online sales during the pandemic has brought in additional revenue to bookstores. With stores reopened, online sales have dropped but still remain higher than pre-pandemic levels. At Flyleaf, online sales are currently a steady 35 to 40% of business, whereas pre-pandemic, it only accounted for 2%. We've essentially sprouted another bookstore in the back, Fielko says. We've had to repurpose some folks and hire for different skills, and I've had to hire an online sales manager now, which I didn't need 18 months ago. For Lorenz de Haas, traffic is currently booming at the regulator, exceeding pre-pandemic levels. Revenue for the month of June is up 18% from June of 2019, he says. Says there was a surge of people visiting the store, a testament to how people missed the act of browsing. While online sales sustained the business during the pandemic, de Haas says he wants in-person sales to continue to be the dominant form of business because he believes there's something irreplaceable about visiting a bookstore. In the middle of last fall, we decided to renew our lease for another 5 years, and went to an attorney to just take a look at the new lease we were signing, just to check it over, de Haas says. And he said, "This is insane. You're the first person that's come to me with a new lease. Everybody is trying to get out of theirs." And the customer volume since stores reopened suggests readers feel the same. On Rafiwa Book Cafe's opening day, Makobili says 200 people visited. Fitch says McIntyre's Books is seeing a lot of new customers, especially families they haven't seen previously. She says people are discovering the store at a higher rate, which she attributes to the store's increased social media and online presence that grew during the pandemic. "It's stunning to me that we're closed 2 days a week and we're not doing events, and we're right in there with what we were doing 2 years ago," Fitch says. Dan Cullen, Senior Strategy Officer at the American Booksellers Association, says independent bookstores rallied despite facing significant pandemic impacts. He says online sales at independent bookstores have increased 680%, and stores successfully pivoted to find new ways to support their communities. The uncertainty is whether increased book sales will sustain into the future now that other forms of entertainment are picking up. Is this an adrenaline rush that just kind of gives out, or is it a new thing where people are reminded of how much they like books? Scherer says. "It's very hard to stop a reading person from reading a lot," Michael Bailey says. "You do get a lot of one-time folks who are coming in to buy, but readers are readers, and they will find the opportunity to finish a book. Readers are a resilient customer base." Next, we turn to the viewpoint of this week's Triangle Business Journal, and the editor's notebook this week is entitled TBJ Expands Coverage to Surrounding Counties. Triangle Business Journal has grown at a rapid pace, especially in the past 3 years, with our subscription base rivaling far bigger cities with business journals. Now, we're adding to our staff to keep pace with the economic growth. In the past few months, we've added 2 critical reporter slots after hearing from many of you about the changes in local demographics and the need for additional business intelligence in specific sectors. First came the need to write stories on counties and towns beyond the focus of our primary counties of Wake, Durham, and Orange. After talking to several economic developers across the state, we decided to add a reporter to cover economic development in our surrounding counties, such as Chatham, Franklin, Granville, Harnett, Johnston, Lee, and Moore. We hired Evan Hoopfer, who is at E-H-O-O-P-F-E-R at bizjournals.com, from our sister paper in Dallas, and he already is forging relationships with economic development directors, real estate executives, transportation personnel, and local government officials so he can understand the need and the strength of the communities. We did exactly that with executives in Raleigh, Durham, Cary, Chapel Hill, Apex, and so many communities in the Tri-County region. That's why we are who we are today, and for that, I thank each and every one of you. Hoopfer's focus will be on the growth in the Greater Triangle region. And in the short time Hoopfer has been writing about developments in these counties, we've noticed a spike in engagement with the audience from these communities. Clearly, we're onto something here, and we promise to build our reporting on this initial success as we talk to more of you to get a better idea of the needs, opportunities, and challenges faced by the residents of those communities. The other beat we created was for Erica Wells, who came to us from Augusta, Georgia. Wells, who can be reached at E-W-E-L-L-S at bizjournals.com, is following the retail and restaurant scene around the Triangle with an added responsibility of covering the business services beat, focusing primarily on mergers and acquisitions and local companies. It is clear our readers love to read about restaurants, shops, chefs, and bartenders. Wells is up and running, chasing leads that already have resulted in some of those red stories on our website. In the next couple of months, we'll be hiring a healthcare and higher education reporter covering what arguably are among the most important sectors of the Triangle economy. Until we have the person on board, please reach out to our digital producer, David Pertell, who is at D-P-U-R-T-E-L-L at bizjournals.com, or managing editor Dane Huffman, who is at D-A-N-E-H-U-F-F-M-A-N at bizjournals.com, with details. We'll figure out a way to cover those stories of local importance. Finally, I wanted to talk about our continuing effort to make our tent bigger. Last week, we started a weekly feature called 52 Shades of Success, focused on businesses started by immigrants, military veterans, members of our disabled community, members of our LGBTQ community, and other minority groups. Between our two digital issues Monday through Friday and the print edition on Friday, we're publishing hundreds of stories every month. It is not only appropriate, but necessary to make sure that we're reporting, researching, and investigating most business groups so our readers can make the best business decisions because of the added intelligence we are presenting in our coverage. This week's guest editorial actually has three authors, James H. Johnson, Jr., and Gene Milliken Bonds. They're professors at Keenan Flagler Business School at Chapel Hill, and Alan Parnell, who is vice president of the Cedar Grove Institute for Sustainable Development in Mebane. And their article is entitled, Demographic Wind Gusts Ahead. Seven demographic trends analogous to gale force wind gusts and an adverse weather event constitute potentially powerful disruptors of business. Four of the gale force demographic disruptors, slowing total, white and foreign-born population growth, and declining fertility, evolved over recent decades. Three, deaths of despair, involuntary retirements, and the declining female workforce, grew from recent crises. Failure to address these disruptors will impact talent recruitment, development, and retention, prime drivers of business competitiveness. The U.S. population has grown more slowly in every decade since 1960. In the most recent decade, the population registered the slowest rate of growth since the 1930s. That was 7.4% compared to 7.3% in the 30s. The slowing of total growth is driven by slowing growth of whites. After increasing by 12% during the 1990s, the white population increased only by 1.2% during the 2000s and by less than 1% between 2010 and 2020. Because of low fertility and aging, deaths outnumber births among whites nationally for the first time in 2016. Further suppressing population growth, women of color are also having fewer children. Foreign-born population growth also has slowed. After increasing by 57% in the 1990s, foreign-born population growth was 24% in the 2000s and 14% in the decade between 2010 and 2019. The slowdown was driven by anti-immigration policies, the Great Recession, and COVID-19. Further clouding our outlook are deaths of despair, loss of life by drug overdoses, suicides, and diseases such as cirrhosis and obesity, which disproportionately impact rural white America, and COVID-19 deaths, which have been disproportionately in Black and Latinx communities. COVID-19 also forced 2 million older workers into involuntary retirement and more than 2 million women out of the workplace. These demographic gale force disruptors will profoundly impact the size and composition of the workforce and consumer markets. Current worker shortages are the first wave of the impacts. Business leaders must audit their enterprises to ensure they've created inclusive and equitable places to work. They must also advocate for policies that, one, reform immigration laws to acknowledge the critical roles immigrants have in our economy. Two, support family-friendly workplaces that provide mothers with flexibility to provide and care for children. Three, attack the child care crisis with accessible, high-quality, and affordable daycare. Four, direct resources to address the root causes of deaths of despair and the racially disparate impact of COVID-19. Five, leverage SBA's Encore Entrepreneurship Training Program to create pathways of reentry into the economy for involuntary retirees. We've run out of time for today's episode. I hope you enjoyed it. I'm Alton Banks, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The Triangle Business Journal is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. So long until next time, thanks for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.